Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need. Welcome to Blueprints. Can you introduce yourself, please?
My name's David Slater. I'm a, I guess, independent journalist based out of Edmonton, and I have some bylines with the Tyee, Edmonton Journal, and Progress Report.
And I'm Ewan Thompson, and I'm based in Halifax, Chibuktuk, and I write at Drug Data Decoded normally, so a lot of drug policy, harm reduction type writing, and I have made various forays into the world of Palestinian resistance activism over the last few years as well.
Both of you can add The Breach to those byline listings, right? And yay, fist pump. Great article. Santiago was, you know, excited about it as well. He sent it, slid it in my DMs, and I was like, I'm already on it, brother. I am already, this is right in our realm. You folks, I'm going to explain it just ever so generally to the audience. You're going to help us pick it apart and tell us how you got there. But David and Ewan just wrote a piece for The Breach that really shows a level of corroboration between universities in an attempt to thwart student attempts at the encampments. And that is generous, right? That is the kindest way to describe the secret chat you've uncovered in your report. So, I mean, we've covered the encampments, you and we've shared some of your work at Drug Decoded because you covered and were a part of one of the encampment clearings. So, I mean, we told the University of Calgary story in pretty intimate detail not that long ago. So I can see why you were interested in digging a little deeper. Do you folks want to start us off on, you know, when you started this investigation and what your motivation was?
Yeah, sure. I'll just say up front, you know, you've interviewed a number of my co-plaintiffs on a lawsuit that, you know, that I'm a part of that is against the Calgary Police and the University of Calgary for what they did on May 9th, 2024, which was a really incredibly violent response to what was a peaceful, pretty low-key protest, an encampment that was made up of, you know, a few dozen students and community members who were helping them out. Just to make their point around divestment and disclosure of investments with Israel and connections, academic connections, all that kind of stuff that all of the other schools across the continent were asking for at that time. And many of us got pretty severely beaten for it by the police, you know, within hours of the encampment opening. So my journey since then has really followed every thread I pull at. There seems to be a giant hidden rock underneath it with bare, you know, covering a bunch of skeletons that the university and other institutions don't want us to know about. And it's been very obvious to me every time I pull on the right thread. So coming into contact with David on this about a year, 16 months ago, we immediately hit it off. We knew what we wanted in this. We thought we had picked up one of those threads that we should really tug on, and I'm really glad that we did. So yeah, David, do you remember exactly how we ended up coming in contact on this?
Yeah, we, through similar circles, we've chatted about this before, about our similar friend circles, but also like the FOIP work that we've both been doing. And that kind of made for fertile ground that we were both interested in. And yeah, I mean, like Ewan hit it right on the nail where we're focused on, you know, institutional accountability, both of us. And so both of our separate reportings kind of converged into this sort of area of interest. And it was after a story that I had written for the Progress Report. And then that's where we kind of met in this field where, you know, your reporting and my reporting both ended up, you know, pointing us in this direction. And then after that, we sort of were sort of off to the races, so to speak.
I love how your separate work also helped point out contradictions. That's part of the fun of reading the articles. You know, two separate folks making FOI requests or requests from these institutions getting two different answers. That's a red flag in itself. And so let's stop teasing folks. Tell us what was that first thread and how many were there? I mean, it starts to get very juicy. There was a feeling that there was corroboration, especially between the two big Alberta campuses, right? We've talked about that. They were cleared 30 hours apart, similar violent circumstances. And so, and the way Danielle Smith, it's linked in the show notes. We can't retell all of it, right? But if you know, you know, right? So that was almost obvious, but you uncovered a lot more than that. Were you surprised how many universities were there? I saw my alma mater. I was scanning. I was like, shit, that doesn't surprise me. Because they were really cleared out of there as well within like hours. So yeah, let's go back. What was that first thread you teased us with that kind of brought you together, if you remember, and share with the audience what you started to uncover?
So I could trace this back at least 2 years for me, where I was pulling documents from U Calgary and they were being very reluctant with the release of documents. There was a lot of redactions, there was a lot of delays, and it was pretty clear they were not operating on a good faith basis in some of this, in some of their dealings on FOI releases. The University of Calgary was sick of me by the time, you know, we got into some of these documents. But one of those threads that I was able to pull out of their documents was this national network that they had been invited to by the University of Toronto. And the University of Toronto security managers had reached out. Hi, Bob. You know, good to get in contact with you again. We're doing this thing. And this was like April 18th, April 20th, that kind of range of time where the encampments were starting to be violently dismantled in the United States. And these stories were starting to bleed up into Canada, where, you know, everybody was just waiting on the edge of their seat for some of these encampments to start up in university campuses in Canada. So I think that, you know, when I look at the timeline of when these security coordination started happening between the universities, it really lines up perfectly and superimposes on the moments when the students were starting to gear up for their encampments. So that was on the national side, and David really started pulling on this on the provincial side.
Previous reporting showed through previous FOIPs how the McEwen University was doing a lot of work to suppress students on campus. And so some of the documents that I was able to find were talking about police assessments, coordination from the police. And this was not the university going to the police saying, hey, we got a problem with students. you know, we need your help. It was the police sending, at least from what I can interpret from the documents and from how heavy the redactions were, was that this was the police providing information to the universities. And so this is all interconnected. So the network that we were, the provincial network that we managed to uncover links to individual actions at each university. And so each university, or at least from the point of view of McEwen, was that they were doing these new activities of surveillance, and they were doing ad hoc surveillance. So they were bringing out their like new cameras that they were purchasing. And like, so like, I have to ask the question, why, like, where's all of this coming from? It's not to say that there's, you know, a very top down, like from the government, you know, suppress students, but it's like all converging interests. The university admins were making these decisions especially at McEwen University is what I was finding. And it was creating this sort of like feeling or more, you know, a silence, squashing dissent at McEwen, right? And then as Ewan and I started to send in requests for the team's chats and for the provincial chats, this is what we were beginning to see that connected to like sort of a broader interconnected between universities, sort of bureaucratic emergency management type of program.
What is the role in the administration that is the key person here? Like, And I have questions about McEwen. You try to answer it in the article, but I'm not sure if there's like a clear answer as to why they are this key player. I had to Google it, right? I was like, I thought maybe they were an overarching like university body, but it's, you know, governing these other two universities, but it's not. They're just a small university. And this Janet Dean is like spearheading. Why? And is that typically their role in Alberta universities? Why such this interest in almost in preemptive, right? A lot of this chatter happened even before some of the encampments were established, right? So it was aimed at preventing. Can you help me understand this?
I don't know that we have a clear answer to that either. What I think the broader point to all of this is, like, yes, we've uncovered, this investigation has uncovered this material, this information, this coordination, this system, but they've deleted so many documents. They've roadblocked us, and so there's a lot that we don't know. But for McEwen, what's interesting is the relationship that they have with the provincial government. And this is not something that we've got into in specifically for our article and for our investigation, but the relationship that these administrations have, all of them, with the provincial governments, and how they interlink, you know, as far as converging interests. You know, we're talking about elite university class. I mean, class is a huge part of this conversation, but that there's a banality to this group, this system, and that, and this is what James Turk talked to us a bit about, how he would expect that universities are talking, coordinating to some degree about safety and security, you know, of their campuses, and that on its face doesn't sound like very much. When Ewan and I first started and we put in our FOIPs, one of the first things that I did was reach out to some contacts at the university, McEwen University, to confirm that this was even a real thing. You know, are we shooting in the dark here? And the response that I got back was absolutely, that this does exist. And it was normal. It was a system. It was, you know, it was a fundamental sort of bureaucratic system that, you know, sounds good on its face, emergency management. And there's lots of sort of like normalcy that goes along with that. But what we've uncovered in the documents that show that it ended up being pointed towards, you know, suppression of student and community and faculty activities, right? But also worth noting too is that the conversation with the emergency managers was that these are peaceful encampments, peaceful protests. Like, the language confirms previous reporting from Jeremy Appel and others that, you know, like, everybody's just exercising their charter rights. And hey, we're conversating with them. We're working with the encampments. Even like, this is, you know, some of the conversation that we were reading. And then notice the disconnect between like what that conversation was, and then what the reaction, and what, like, so who are making ultimately the calls? And so hopefully was able to answer a little bit of your question there, but that there is this like structure.
I would add, as an outsider to McEwen, I've never been a student there, but I've always noticed, at least in recent years under the UCP government, while other schools did try to stem the flow to some extent of this political manhandling that the UCP has done with all institutions across the province, you know, nonprofit sector included, to get people to step in line, McEwen just seemed to dive in head first and get in line right away. And they've done a lot of like political announcements. They've invited MLAs in to make those. There's a lot of sort of business alignment because they're right downtown Edmonton, right? So this nexus of the UCP's sort of business first model, it really has unfolded within the confines of McEwen on this sort of microcosm level. So when I think about McEwen, that's the thing that jumps to my mind. And it really played out in some of the quotes that we were able to pull from the communications of like the provost, the morning of the encampment starting up, said the funniest thing because he was getting ready to make this big announcement about their business school opening up, the Trifo School of Business. And we looked into like, who is this Trifo person? Turns out he's the former chair and CEO of Stantec, which had just recently partnered with the Israeli Defense Forces to build infrastructure in Gaza. So and this guy, the provost, was telling his colleagues at McEwen, you know, and University of Alberta, let's hope for a quiet day for the groundbreaking. That was his sort of wish for this day. And you know, hours later, you can just picture him getting news that the student encampment had formed up.
Yeah.
Someone ruined his day.
The McEwen University is tight, and the School of Business is the school's like crown jewel, right? They're very proud of it. There was much to do about its opening. It really does show like how this linkage between like what's happening on the ground to faculty and students really overarches, right? This links to imperialism. This links to, you know, what's happening in Palestine, right? And so like we're not separate in this world, right?
Absolutely. I want to hit on your comment that, you know, it's bureaucratic in nature and likely something they do for other purposes, right? It's an industry. They talk to one another. It doesn't have to be nefarious. But let's talk about some of the things we saw in the chats. I think in the quote in the article, it's not just a mundane chat, right? They were sharing the tactics that they were using on each campus, reporting back as to how that was going. But then they were also talking about facial recognition and this kind of collaboration with police element. Do you want to hit on what wasn't redacted, what you managed to see them sharing with one another? Because I don't think it surprises people, but a number of universities, you know, called the cops to clear the encampment, but the cops needed a court injunction. We kind of knew that with McGill and U of T, but University of New Brunswick, was it, did it as well. What else did you find that kind of points to more of an act of suppression of charter rights than just universities preparing for inevitable disruptions?
I think my head immediately goes to just the level of secrecy that both of these networks were applying to ensure that the information didn't get out and didn't come back around to them. So for one thing, you know, they had these sort of terms of reference that when you enter into the national discussion anyway, like, be careful what you say was kind of the language. You know, this is all FOIPable. This could end up being traced back to you. So just be careful what you put into this message board and that kind of thing. But even then, you know, they were sharing their tactics, just like you say. You know, University of Guelph was in there talking about how they're target hardening all of their campus locations. They revealed to us outside of the context of the FOI. They just answered us when we asked them, last week, what were you doing? What was the idea behind all this? They revealed that they had also mounted security cameras to monitor the students and monitor the encampment.
Whoever answered that call.
There was a lot more. Say again, sorry.
I'm wondering whoever answered that call and then sees it in print is likely regretting talking.
Well,
I personally
appreciated the level of transparency they were willing to give there, and so credit to Guelph for, you know, answering a question, because most of the institutions would not. And most of them would not even reply to us, let alone give a straight answer. The ones that did give any kind of answer, it was deflection, it was dismissal, it was just boilerplate stuff. They didn't want us to have any more information than we already have. And I think they didn't actually have any idea how much information we had either. So, just to give you an idea, like David and I have submitted freedom of information requests to almost a dozen institutions for this story alone. And they really covered a lot of ground. You know, that's a year's worth of submissions, pretty much nonstop. And so I think we did take some of these institutions a little bit by surprise.
Mm-hmm. The language too is, so when we hear phrases like target hardening, to them, that's typical, normal security language. Sarah Carpenter, in our interview with her, this was some of the stuff that that she talked about. And this might not have made it into the final draft, but she was talking about this professionalization of security of campuses, and this leads into this, like, again, I don't want to use the word benign, but it's like it comes into this sort of this is their job, this is their scope of work, and we end up seeing the effects of, you know, violations of charter rights, overt surveillance, use of police violence, but also police coordination. So we're talking about, so the questions that arise are like, well, who's surveilling who? Where are they surveilling them? So speaking specifically to some of the students from McEwen, who I've interviewed a few times for this, different protests and demonstrations, not just for this story, but it was all a through line of repression, right, of squashing dissent. And so there's this professionalization of this language that sort of like blankets and kind of nullifies like the real seriousness of it, at least in my opinion, of what we were experiencing or what students are experiencing, in that here we are on campus exercising constitutional rights, and yet they're being subjected to increased surveillance and through administrative discipline measures as well. One of the which university, I think it was the University of Athabasca, was suggesting that they would discipline their students for demonstrations at the U of A, right? And like, what? And this is where I think, like, maybe you and I, at times when we're reading this, we're like, I don't even, you know, you have to discern like really what it is that you're reading, because you have to almost put yourself in the position of the person writing it or the person saying it. So like, what does that mean coming out of their mouth, right?
They act with such impunity.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. They were completely convinced of their righteousness in the actions they took here, is the sort of, and this really falls back onto Jeremy Appel's reporting from a year and a half ago as well. He put out a series of two stories in February, March 2025, uncovering a lot of the University of Calgary's attitudes and positioning towards the way the students were trying to express their constitutional rights. And they were treated like threats from the very beginning of this. And there really was no room left for those students to exercise their rights, to make their point, and to make any, let alone make any demands of the university. So I really think that's partly where this comes from, where a lot of that violence was justified internally.
Mm-hmm. I think the interesting point that you just made is that this is really how universities see their students, as threats. And even as the emergency managers would be using this like professionalization language, they may not like understand like really what those implications really mean. Like these aren't faculty members. They're not professors. They're not participating in the learning that's going on in the institution. They're there as a securitization of the campuses and universities. And so,
and many of them are ex-cops as well.
Yeah. 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 And at least like from their professional backgrounds, they're completely removed from post-secondary. Like they're brought in externally as professional security managers. And so there really is this militarization you know, in some, even in these benign sort of administrative bureaucratic ways, but look how the layers compound and they relate to each other, culminating into police surveillance, police violence.
I think that brings up a really important point, David, as well, is in that, you know, people make a big deal about this sort of an unregulated police force that exists within CN Rail, for example. You know, we have these train cops essentially that don't really have the same sort of oversight that a normal police force has. That is true on campuses now too. Campuses all have essentially police forces that are working hand in glove with their local police. They're feeding information to them. They're coordinating responses, and there's really no reason to consider campus police nowadays as any different than the sort of militarization that we're seeing replicated within local police forces as well.
Can we talk about that police coordination within that provincial or national network? Can you clarify? Did you notice police in the national network discussions and chats? Were they contributing to those discussions?
Not directly. Their information was being fed into these networks. So particularly the Alberta network had, essentially some people liaising with the local police and then feeding like briefings and intelligence reports into the network. Of course, we don't have those. We didn't get them, but they were mentioned, and so that information was being passed around. U Calgary, U Alberta certainly coordinating, because I think they recognized themselves as probably the nexus of where the student activity was going to be.
I ask because also like it's even linked actually to your article on the Breach website, which will be linked in the show notes for folks who need to read it, which is everyone. It's another investigation by the Breach on the CRUBC on campus in BC. So this is the RCMP unit that had previously been tasked with, I don't know what the political speech is, but, you know, policing Indigenous resistance to pipelines. And they were on campus around the time everyone is preparing for encampments and, you know, Palestinian solidarity work is ramping up. And so I wonder, you know, which police forces and at what level were involved with coordinating universities across national levels. I know that is a BC unit, but it is still a federal unit and it's been tasked with, like, you know, now they've broadened its scope. That's why they changed, among other reasons, changed its name. But, you know, it's like basically any shit disturbers, you know, we're tasked with policing them and preventing disruptions. So do you have any other insights that maybe weren't even shared in the article as to what level police were involved with this?
Our documents don't reveal much about specific police briefings. Like those weren't included in the documents. But as Ewan mentioned, there is the conversation utilizing those police reports and risk assessments. And so, and this leads back to both of our separate reporting, you know, before we worked on this investigation, is that there is this connection of these universities utilizing like a police as a third party, helping to police, working within the community, policing, broadly speaking. And as you've pointed out, like there's these conversations about between these people utilizing, you know, these risk assessments and police assessments and surveillance assessments. And like, what are the details? We don't know. But what we've been able to determine, and this is not something that we put in our work specifically for this investigation, was that like the way that the university, even in themselves, so McCune, I will bring it back to McCune University, like they were surveilling students' social medias. And so, and I've obtained from previous reporting, like screenshots of all of that. So it's very detailed. And if they're doing to that level of detail than what our police provided.
Yeah, and that was happening at UCalgary as well, as per Jeremy Appel's reporting from last year. And I think it's also just worth thinking a little bit about the sort of hidden threads behind all of this, which we've identified as now connecting in the Alberta government. I mean, this is a smoking gun that journalists have been looking for some time now. Who was the connection point for the Alberta government into these university responses ahead of the encampments? And we knew already from the University of Alberta's report, their independent report by Judge Adele Kent, issued in the end of 2024, that there was at least one meeting with really high up cabinet members like Mike Ellis, the public safety and emergency response minister. The premier's office was in the room, that kind of stuff. But they went to great pains, great lengths to try and explain that none of this was in any kind of aggressive stance. They were going to take a really conciliatory approach to any encampments that got set up. And so that was all publicized that way. They never mentioned this other meeting that happened on May 3rd, a week before the encampment set up. They never said anything about this or the man who appears to have been this back channel between the government and the university security managers. So yeah, this high level meeting may have gone up and is now sort of documented in this official report. The unofficial activity that was going on was never documented anywhere publicly. And that is, to me, the smoking gun that links Danielle Smith's government into the violent response. And we know how tight the UCP government is with their police forces in Alberta, politically, morally, ethically, and just in their worldview. So, I think that's something new here.
That is like a story in itself, right? Not just what you uncovered or almost uncovered. You know, there is still more that we want to know, but it's the FOI aspect, right? The freedom of information, the way folks are preemptively trying to thwart those efforts. And then after, through the entire process, in Ontario as well, we've got a premier that's looking to change laws around freedom of information requests to make it more difficult because they know that this type of reporting can get to the bottom of some of the stuff that we can't understand, that we kind of sense but can't prove, and, ways to hold them accountable. Do you want to hit on that a little bit? And also, as you talk about it, maybe provide tips to other folks out there who are looking to get to the bottom of incidents that have happened on campus or, trying to dig around to see what their provincial government is doing. I know they're not all the same, but yeah, was that a surprise to you, or have you faced this level of redaction and resistance covering other issues?
Well, we'll back up a little bit and maybe hit on some of the FOIP stuff. So, in relation to what you mentioned earlier about the title here is Blueprints of Disruption, and so anybody can file FOIPs, and it's this is legislation that's like been historical legislation for the purposes of transparency and accountability of our public institutions, and this is why I think. What's important about maintaining the trust and integrity of our public institutions, this all like will link us into like the public service of what we do, right? But as far as like this type of journalism, but what's important with this, with obtaining documents through FOIP, through Freedom of Information, province to province, is that you have a document. And so it's not simply someone said something. It's no, we have a piece of paper. We have a document type that says, this is what they said. This is what they talked about, or this is what they planned. And no matter the story, like this sort of transcends, all type of different reporting, is that this is the importance. It brings it back to the importance of like what Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Acts are for, right? And so the process of us going through that can, we can get into the weeds and can get really, really muddy. But really what I think that I would want to emphasize is that, that this process is available for anybody, not just journalists. In fact, when you look at some of the stats about who accesses Freedom of Information, journalists are one of the very few that do it in comparison to other government officials, corporations and business people, academics. Those are the larger sort of aggregate of users. Public and journalists are some of the least used or users of the system. And so I would encourage everybody to file more FOIPs. I think it's just good practice, you know.
Flood the zone, though.
Yes. Yeah. But
they
I
won't
mean,
know
it's,
who's asking.
Yeah. It's all for public interest. And so, and there is a difference between a general request and a personal request. Your general requests are like what we've been working on, costs money. They can put in delays and fee estimates and stuff like that. But when you file private personal requests, those are free. And generally, you can get a lot of useful information that can connect to filing other FOIP requests. So I don't want to get too deep into it, but really, this kind of underscores the importance of like this type of reporting that we're doing, is that it's really more than interviewing so-and-so and so-and-so saying, you know, XYZ, this is what happened. But like, we have now a document that says XYZ did happen, that government official so-and-so did say something. And now that we can go to the experts, we can go to the people that are affected and then, you know, get reactions from them. And then this builds a public conversation, and that builds on bringing it back to encampments and demonstrations and anti-genocide. Is that I would hope that our reporting can help with the public conversation, build accountability, build transparency. So far, right, there's no one's been held accountable for any of this. And so this is where I think maybe some of these roads can lead to, right, is having a conversation about charter rights and who's responsible for, you know, denying those to community, to students, to faculty.
Yeah, and very selfishly, I want to see more people in the public submitting these requests, because I think there would be a tremendous amount of outrage among the public if they knew the shenanigans that some of these public bodies get up to withhold, redact, refuse access to documents that should be absolutely public. We shouldn't even have to ask for some of this stuff, right? Budget documents, of contract agreements with security companies that are setting up CCTV on campuses and doing, you know, facial recognition potentially. That stuff should be publicly posted. We shouldn't even need to ask for it. But let alone like the amount of redactions, the time it takes to get them, the money you have to spend. It's outrageous when you get into it. And it's really an important democratic exercise for, I think, any member of the public that wants to start you know, applying themselves within this so-called democracy that we have. It becomes very abundantly clear very quickly how twisted and contorted our system has become to protect people in power.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of our experience shows how closed off these institutions really are, how insulated and isolated they are at higher levels. There's this feeling of contempt, you know, from admin about their students, about their faculty, even that there is this elite class that operates these public institutions that take public dollars that are supposed to be providing a public service, and they're almost run as mini fiefdoms. And I'm connected to larger elite, you know, business interests and political interests in our provinces.
Yeah, that's where that class question really comes into play, right? When you're trying to understand why they behave this way. I mean, the Palestinian exception is there, obviously, but I made that last question like a five-parter, so I blame you not for answering. Were you surprised that at this, like, was it eye-opening to see the level of tactics used to you know, thwart your efforts, like 16 months or 2 years, I guess, if we're dating it all the way back, right? To uncover, surely you don't work that slow. This took so long because you were, you know, blockade after blockade. Was that unusual? You've written stories before.
I think David and I were both aware that we were touching something hot here, and they didn't want us to have it. So we had to exercise a lot of patience for sure. But we knew we were onto something when they started applying this level of secrecy. And, you know, I was used to dealing with a pretty belligerent University of Calgary around some of its document releases and the ways that they were withholding things. So this didn't seem too surprising to me, but it did certainly tell us that we were onto something important when they were so desperate to withhold these records.
Any advice? Like, were there times that your requests were processed easier, like, or viewed as less threatening? Did you perfect your request in any way? Or do you know, was it just perseverance?
We both learned so much, I think, along the way with this and really sharpened our technique over time. I think David and I worked really well together on this front, just managing our records, sharing stuff together, going through it together, highlighting the important bits, going back over records that, you know, this is painstaking work. You're looking at sometimes 150 pages of very densely coded language around what they're doing. And, you know, I think this is partly why some of these administrators are paid so much, is that they're very good at covering their tracks through their emails, through other means of communication, using other means of communication so that they don't need to share them through FOI, for example. I think there's a lot that we didn't get as a result of all that. And there's a lot that became so opaque through the language that it's almost impossible to know what they're talking about. Like, only they would know. But that said, you know, David can speak, I think, to the University of Alberta experience versus some of the others.
The University of Alberta has been, of all of the privacy offices, one of the best ones that we've been dealing with. Ewan's right that there is really this, there is a process, there is a way to have a conversation with the public body, because you're not talking to the administrators. You're not talking to the people who actually have the documents. You're speaking to administrators in their privacy and access offices. A lot of the benefits to what we were doing together was that we had each other to work off of. And so we would be sending each other emails like, hey, check out this response. What do you think? That's really important in utilizing and leveraging each other's experience. And this is what I would like to say to others that are foraying into this field, is that find experts, find people with experience, have no fear about reaching out. Reach out to us, please. We're happy to help. Other people are happy to help too. And people in the FOI Freedom of Information like field, even ex access officers and others within the field are happy to help. Some of these people very much believe in the mission of Freedom of Information. This was actually something that came back from the U of A, was after one of my requests, emails that I was having back and forth, was I think that I had said, hey, you know, thank you very much. You know, this has been really helpful. And the response back was, do you mind me sharing this with our director? Because she really does believe in this mission. And so there are people in parts within these institutions that are operating in good faith. Contrast to that is McEwen. The contrast to that is University of Calgary. And some of these other national universities as well, but that the way that they respond to us is, and maybe anybody, it could have been anybody that was, you know, submitting these documents requests, is that, you know, delay, deny, all right, and there's this formal process they use using the legislation. This is where my advice would be. For anybody getting into it, is that you have to read the act. You have to know like what the act is saying and what and what it allows them and what it allows you to do, because it helps you craft those better conversations. But they would use these sections in the act to deny access to documents. And sometimes they would just say, they would just use a certain section and then that's that.
And I hope but you then, don't know what that means.
And hope that you don't know what that means. And then when Ewan and I would, you know, escalate to the Office of the Information and Privacy Commissioner, there is another level of, and this is getting into the weeds a little bit, of like informal mediation. And so the commissioner prefers to, you know, to sort that out between the applicant and the public body as best as possible, right? And we've had successes there. We've had instances where it didn't work and you have to escalate to mediation, right? But this is not just us. This is not just a journalist dealing with journalists. This is like any applicant. So there is this level of or type of experience that, you know, one should and one will gather over time in dealing with freedom of information.
I'm glad you mentioned that office, because one of my questions there was, are you hopeful that some of your appeals, particularly, we didn't get to mention the missing video footage of the University of Calgary encampment and clearing, so the police violence, was that footage was apparently deleted or whatever. It's just one of those things they won't provide to you, and you've made an appeal. Are you hopeful some of the things that are outstanding will get to uncover and get an update on?
Oh, to be clear, we have a massive trove of body cam footage that we just can't really talk about because there are law enforcement review board appeals, including mine, that are still in front of, you know, going through their legal process. And so on. But I do feel validated. I can say that much in all the claims I have made so far about what happened to me. So at least, you know, there's that much. The CCTV footage from the University of Calgary is a fascinating case study in weaponization of the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act. In Alberta, it's called the Access to Information Act and the Protection of Privacy Act, two separate ones now. And what they've done essentially is said that because there are people's faces on the security camera footage, they can't share it with me. And that's just, it's ludicrous, because there is just a massive public body of footage identifiable for every individual that was in that crowd that night, identifiable at the level of probably police officers. There's no reason to be withholding that at this stage, in my opinion. And yet they're still hiding behind this act. 2 years later, this is 2 years now that I've been trying to get this, and well over a year and a half that the OIPC has been, the commissioner's office has been, you know, working to also extract it from the University of Calgary. So there's something in there. It tells me there's something really, really spicy in there, and they do not want me to have it.
There is a sharpening of the work that we've done over time, and we've been able to leverage each other's experience, and like Ewan has been noting that, like we've learned so much, and so an important point to this is that when you are appealing and when you're going through this like appeal process, it really is incumbent on you to assess as best as possible, like what are your highest chances of success in dealing with, like, because you have to make very specific complaints. And so you don't want to make spurious complaints. You don't want to do something that will endanger the chances of the Office of the Information and Privacy Commissioner ruling in your favor, right? And there's been rulings that we've both gotten that have been like, not what we've wanted, or that we even agree with, but it comes back to sort of this negotiation and conversation with now the Office of the Information and Privacy Commissioner. And you have to, I mean they have a job to do, and they're doing it to the best of their abilities within, you know, the legislation, you know, that's written and that's been rewritten by our governments, right? And so they would like to see changes as well to improve right? Our legislation, we've in Alberta, we've seen legislation get worse from the previous FOIP Act to the ATI Act, with notable changes, and I couldn't list them off individually right now, but that favors the public body in operating in secrecy. And so where I would hope that maybe part of this story can help with another public conversation is the robustness and the accuracy and the correctness of our access to information laws, and how they've changed to sort of serve the state rather than the people over these last couple years, 10 or so years.
Yeah, it's the protection of this information is now written into law in some ways. I do think that there's some important discussions maybe to be had around escalating some of these cases up to a more formal legal channel. These are the barriers. These are the sort of dead ends that you run into with freedom of information law now, that governments and public institutions have gotten wise to how they can really weaponize it. But, if there are lawyers out there that are interested in taking some of this stuff on, you know, there's thousands of journalists across the country that would sure love to see, a class action suit or something mounted to just for the amount of time wasted and the commercial losses that have been suffered on account of journalism, not being able to get a hold of documents that they should have gotten, or having them delayed until the story doesn't matter anymore. And so I think that that's, those legal channels should be maybe explored a little bit more. And maybe it's just a matter of having somebody that's able to take some of this to court to say, look, bring it in front of a judge. We don't want to deal with the toothless OIPC anymore, or the places where it can't really do much because of the law, the way it's written. But here's why it's public interest, and we'll make the case in front of a judge in court.
Absolutely. Because it's clear, like, while there's a counter movement to remedy this, there is clearly a move by those in power to limit access, right, to the information that we need to hold them accountable. So your story really is two stories in one, or multiple, because all these campuses have stuff to deal with now that the stories broke. Hopefully their students help hold them accountable as well. It is heartening to know, though, that there's people working on finding ways to push this through, right? Whether it's new legislation or just ways to work the system better, because we don't know what we don't know, And I do love, though, how you were able to, their secrecy was actually their tell. Right, was actually their downfall in the end. So hopefully they're not learning much from this experience, because we don't need them getting more secretive and more adept at hiding what goes on behind closed doors. And like I said at the beginning, it wasn't surprising, because like we all feel it, right? We all feel this, the class collusion. Like they collaborate so much better sometimes than we do, right? Our enemy class. But having the receipts, right? That's really what those documents are. Those are the receipts, the proof that you needed. It's likely why Guelph gave you the statement you did, right? Because you were able to say, hey, we've got this freedom of information request that, you know, proves you guys were doing this. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your bits of wisdom too, even if it's in the weeds, because there's like a lot of people out there that are just trying to get to the bottom of local stories, right? Pollution in Lake Simcoe, where did it come from? Like, it's never ending, the stuff that they don't tell us that we have to work so hard to get to. So all that knowledge is very important. I feel like a workshop needs to be had.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, because I used to make them as part of one of my jobs for fire reports, really mundane. So I know what you mean. And the only time they came really slow was with you were asking a teeny tiny fire department for their, and they just didn't have a working photocopier. And I didn't get anything nefarious in my way. So I don't think everybody faces these barriers when it comes to dealing with these offices, right? It seems to be pointed. Santiago, you've been quiet. Do you have anything you want to say to these fellows before we let them escape to their next interview?
I guess one thing I want to say is thank you for the amazing investigative work that this is. You know, it is a dying art, unfortunately, in this country, where because of the state that media is, a lot of people just don't have the time and the resources to put that many hours, that much effort behind a story. And when I read something like this, I immediately, the first thing I think of is how many stories like this are going untold? You know, how much are we not uncovering? So when we do get something like this, it's just, it's so incredibly valuable. And yeah, that, I don't really have any questions. I just really had a statement, but
Thanks so much for that. I appreciate that deeply. And if there's one thing I can add to it, it's really just that, like, there's no way right now to be paid fairly for the amount of work that goes into this. And, you know, that's okay for some of us. David and I are motivated by other things anyway. And, you know, there's a much deeper sort of seething fire driving us through this work that no amount of money would ever actually ever really outstrip. So, but I do look around, you know, at some of the ways that journalists have to just scrape by right now in this country. And I just want to put the call out to anybody out there who, if you're thinking about, you know, if a journalist comes to your mind right now that is independent out there, just trying to get by on a, you know, on a, like a blog type website and doing some freelancing on the side. You know, for me, it's Jeremy Appel comes to mind. We, you know, so much of the work that David and I did for this story rested and relied on the foundational work that Jeremy did. So, you know, huge credit to him, but look, take a look at his work, like go support some of these people that are out there, you know, just dishing out incredible story after incredible story for free access in the public sphere because they're motivated by other things. They still do need to eat. So look after those people. If there's somebody that jumps to your mind right now, please just go to their site and send them money every month.
Yes. Yes. There is really, you were mentioning, Santiago, the state of media and journalism. We are in an uncertain time, but also a time of great opportunity. And it sounds a little bit, you know, pie in the sky, but I think that independent, you know, non-commercial, non-corporate media journalism is so important. We are able to tell the story that was there to tell. We weren't confined by advertiser pressure. We weren't confined by ownership pressure. We didn't have some of the pitfalls or the pressures that were present, you know, from, you know, corporate reporting. And there's lots of really great reporters out there reporting for large corporate media outlets, but are confined by the very structures that they're a part of. And I think that as we're seeing this sort of scaling back and there's degradation of a lot of like corporate media in Canada and I mean like and around the world, is that it opens up places for independent and independent media to exist. And we can do these stories because they need to be told. But yes, reporters still need to live in capitalism, right? And so, we need your help as much as everybody else. And that helps to get the stories out. And so, if there is someone out there that their reporting resonates with you, then by all means, like the more help that you can give them, the better. So. Yes. And thank you for your kind words. We appreciate it. And it helps motivate us to continue.
Absolutely.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Helu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.